Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an appraisal of the Senate hearings today on Russian hacking ahead of tomorrow's briefing of President-elect Trump, who has persistently disparaged the intelligence community's conclusion that Russia hacked the election and that President Putin authorized the operation. Stephen Pfeiffer, who served as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council, joins us to discuss what possible motives Trump has for going out of his way to defend Putin in the face of mounting evidence that the Russian leader was behind an attack that struck at the heart of American democracy itself, which may have sowed the seeds of illegitimacy and instability in the U.S. presidency and exposed divisions within the ruling Republican Party. Then we look further into the Senate hearings and the growing rift between the president-elect and the intelligence community with Simon Rosenberg, the president and founder of the New Democrat Network and a columnist for U.S. News & World Report. He joins us to discuss whether the choice of the head of Exxon as Secretary of State represents big oil fighting back against growing concerns over global warming and lessening dependence on oil, with Putin and Trump forming a drill baby drill union in the name of the U.S. getting along better with nuclear-armed Russia. Then finally, we'll examine the dilemma facing Republicans who want to immediately repeal Obamacare but do not have anything to replace it with. A veteran insider from the for-profit health industry, who was chief corporate spokesman at Cigna and head of corporate communications at Humana, Wendell Potter, joins us. He is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity, and we will discuss Republican plans to pass a budget resolution that would shield repeal legislation from a Democratic filibuster, thus enabling the GOP to gut the Affordable Care Act in the form of a reconciliation bill. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
And what did you make of today's Senate hearings ahead of a meeting tomorrow between Donald Trump and the heads of the National Security Agency, the CIA, the Director of National Intelligence, and the head of the FBI? They also, in the hearings, the report that apparently the president got today that he asked for will be made public on Monday. But I take it in tomorrow's briefing, President-elect Trump will be getting a lot more information than just about anybody else except President Obama.
Right. Well, I took a couple of takeaways from the hearing today. First of all, the representatives from the intelligence community, led by General Clapper, they didn't want to get ahead of the briefing that they were giving the president in the afternoon that they'll give Mr. Trump tomorrow and that will be released next week. But second, they also conveyed a message that they were very, very certain, both about the nature of the Russian hacking and the interference in the election, and also their view of the intelligence community, which is that this had to be improved at the senior most levels in Moscow. So President Obama has received the briefing. President Trump will receive the briefing tomorrow. My understanding is that both the president and the president-elect will get the full briefing, including with a lot of information that may not be shared even within the U.S. government. There'll be kind of a second briefing within the U.S. government, and then there'll be the unclassified briefing, which reportedly will be released on Monday.
But there was a certain amount of upset, I guess, for the want of a better description, in answering questions from Senator McCain and Graham. The Director of National Intelligence, General Clapper, was asked about how the intelligence community feels about being dissed by President-elect Trump. And he did find it uncomfortable. On the one hand, he said, well, you know, everybody should be skeptical of intelligence. It's never 100% right. But on the other hand, it's not very helpful to be so disparaging. What's your sense of what's going on within the community itself? Because Senator Schumer made a remark the other day saying, you know, the last people you want to alienate in Washington are the intelligence community. They can come back to bite you.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I fully agree with Senator Schumer, but no, I have talked to people in the intelligence community, and there's an understandable frustration there. And these people work hard. They try to come up with the best judgments, often when they don't have complete information. And, you know, in this case, you have an assessment that all 17 intelligence agencies of the United States government have agreed on, which was there was a Russian hacking of the DNC emails. Those were then released, and it was designed to affect the American presidential election. And I think there's a sense of frustration that, you know, it's rejected, or that analysis is rejected by the president-elect without any basis other than it somehow doesn't conform with his worldview. Now, hopefully after he gets the briefing tomorrow, we'll see a more considered and certainly a more informed reaction from the president-elect. But I think people are a little bit frustrated in the intelligence community because, you know, they do their analysis, they do their assessments, and they want to have some assurance that it's going to be read at the top, at least with an open mind, as opposed to being, you know, rejected if it doesn't conform with preset views.
Well, when you talk about Donald Trump's worldview, of course, this is the man that propagated the Bertha conspiracy for many years. And a lot of people were wondering whether it was cynical or he actually believes it. But my understanding is one of the people that he'll be meeting with tomorrow, Donald Trump, is the head of the National Security Agency, Admiral Rogers. And Admiral Rogers was the very first person to visit Trump on the day that he was on his first day after being elected. He was his first visitor in Trump Tower. And Admiral went there to protect his job because the Obama administration were trying to get rid of him, as was the DNI. And apparently he's a friend of Mike Flynn, the National Security Advisors. And the meeting didn't go well because Trump laid into Admiral Rogers about Benghazi, saying, how come you guys in the NSA were covering up Benghazi? And the Admiral saying, what? There's no there. And it ended in total disarray in a shouting match. This is maybe, is that a possibility at the heart of the problem, is you have somebody that believes a lot of crazy stuff?
Well, again, I think we'll have a better fix after tomorrow. You're going to have the director of national intelligence, you're going to have the head of the CIA, the head of the FBI, and the head of the National Security Agency. And they'll have the opportunity to lay out their case to the president-elect, and hopefully he gives it due consideration. Right now, I think, though, people are a little bit nervous that we may have somebody coming into the Oval Office who has some prefixed views and won't adjust those views even if there's conflicting information, and we'll have to see on that one.
And what's your sense of what's going on in Moscow, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, since you served as there in the Moscow, the U.S. Embassy? And again, Stephen Pfeiffer is the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, and he is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and served on the National Security Council as Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. So what's your sense then of what's going on with Vladimir Putin? Is there some other explanation for why Donald Trump goes out of his way to, in effect, defend Putin in the face of mounting evidence?
Yeah, I don't understand Mr. Trump's defense of Russian actions, but I imagine in the Kremlin they're quite happy now. They're probably popping the champagne bottles. I mean, first of all, if you look at policy, over the course of the last year and a half, Mr. Trump has said some things which would be music to Mr. Putin's ears. He's talked about lifting economic sanctions on Russia, the sanctions that the United States and European Union put in place after Russia's illegal seizure of Crimea and its support for the separatist conflict in eastern Ukraine. He's talked about recognizing Crimea's incorporation by Russia. He's talked about changing the terms of America's engagement with NATO allies. He's called the alliance obsolete. If you're in Moscow, what's not to like? So I think there's a sense in Moscow, let's give Mr. Trump some room to see if he changes some policies in ways that would comport with Russian interest. The second point here, though, is my guess is at one level the Russians might have preferred that the word not get out, that they were behind the DNC email hack. But on the other hand, if you look at it, you know, this is played out in a way that I think they're quite happy with, because there's now division even within the Republican ranks. It does put a certain cloud over Mr. Trump as he takes the oath of office in a little bit over 2 weeks. Now, I mean, I personally think there's no way that you can relitigate the election. Donald Trump won. We can't go back and say that that individual in Scranton voted for Mr. Trump because of the leaks that were propagated by the Russians through WikiLeaks. So that's an issue that we can't relitigate. But on the other hand, as president, you know, Mr. Trump should be concerned that a major adversarial power, you know, tried to influence, you know, the heart of our democratic system. And the fact that that's a dispute and it's causing this kind of back and forth, even between Republicans, I think that's probably very welcome in Moscow.
But do you think, does Vladimir Putin himself have a distorted worldview? I mean, he was a minor player in the KGB. The more talented people went to the major capitals in the West. He was stuck in East Germany. And my sense is that that in many ways, you know, he's obsessed with, you know, Glavny Protivnik, the main enemy. And he has a sort of foreign policy that's more reactive to the United States as opposed to, you know, in other words, he's trying to do what he can to counter and damage the United States as opposed to do what he can to raise Russia up because, you know, he runs a kleptocracy and this has been very convenient for him. In many ways, the sanctions have played into his hands. He can always blame the West, and he does. You know, he needs the main enemy.
A couple comments. I mean, first of all, yes, he served in the KGB in a relative backwater in Eastern Germany, but I also would not underestimate his intelligence. I think Mr. Putin is fairly smart. Now, having said that, he does bring something of a Cold War approach to how he looks at the United States. And he may well be in a situation where it's easier for him to look at ways to bring down the United States or sow dissension between the United States and Europe. That may be easier for them than actually building up Russia, in part because he's neglected over the last several years to take the necessary economic reform steps that would actually get the Russian economy, you know, really growing. Now, the Russian economy at the end of this, at the end of 2016, it came out of recession, but most experts project for the Russian economy a period of long-term stagnation. The other problem that I think we have with Mr. Putin is that he also, though, has a set of prefixed views, which I don't think comport correctly with the reality of the last 25 years. So, for example, when he looks at NATO enlargement, he doesn't see it as the alliance responding to the requests of countries like Poland and the Czech Republic to come into a European and a transatlantic club. He sees that really as motivated very strongly by an anti-Russian push to bring military forces up to Russia's border. Likewise, he doesn't look at the Maidan Revolution in 2014 in Ukraine or the Orange Revolution back in 2004. He doesn't see those as popular manifestations of public dissatisfaction with either stolen elections or poor authoritarian governments. He sees all of that as organized by the CIA and British MI6 and German intelligence, again designed to hem in Russia. Now, I think on both counts, the revolutions in Ukraine and on NATO enlargement, he's completely wrong, but he has this fixed worldview, and the problem is I don't think we're going to be able to figure out a way to persuade him of something else. So we have to understand how he looks at the world because that will shape his reactions.
Well, but in effect, gangster rule in Russia is working in terms of his popularity. He's gone up from 80 to 85%, I believe, in the latest polls. And, you know, the choice for the Ukrainians and the Estonians and all the people on the neighborhood, notwithstanding whether or not NATO movement eastward was counterproductive, but nevertheless, with the exception of Belarus, which is run by a criminal, isn't that what the choice these people have and in these neighboring states? And that's the choice that Putin's giving them. You know, it's either, you know, I'll destabilize you or you accept gangster rule. And the, I mean, by the way, the guy that Putin put in Crimea, it's a gangster.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you completely on that. No, I mean, this is the problem. I mean, you have in a country like Ukraine a desire now, which I think is shared by certainly a majority of the population. They would like to live like Europeans. And part of that is because they want to have the European standard of living, which is much higher than that in Ukraine, but also they just want to have the normalcy of European rule of law. And I know it means bureaucracy and stuff, but it means less corruption. It means their votes count. It means, you know, that they actually have the right and the ability to exercise some degree of political choice. And in Moscow, that is now seen as a threat. So you have that clash, and you see that clash taking place every day along the line of contact in eastern Ukraine when the shelling goes back and forth. And it's hard now to figure out a way for Ukraine to break out of that, but there's no doubt in my mind that most Ukrainians, in fact, want to break out of that.
Well, just in closing, though, if ever there is a escalation of conflict, either with the Baltics and with the resumption of a larger scale war in Ukraine, at the end of the day, isn't Putin creating kind of a guerrilla army against him? In other words, even building up the military as he's done, and obviously one doesn't want to test Article 5 because that may end up with a nuclear war, but short of that, using the hybrid techniques that Putin's had so far, it seems that his only real achievement in terms of Russian security is actually to make his neighbors hate and fear him.
That's entirely correct. I recall, I guess it was about 2 years ago when I visited Kyiv. This was about maybe 5 months after the Maidan Revolution. So this would have been in the fall of 2014. And a longtime contact I'd had, a Ukrainian, said, you know, Vladimir Putin has succeeded where centuries of Ukrainian nationalists failed. And that is, he's created a sense of Ukrainian national identity that the Ukrainian population has united around. And he said, and it has a very strong anti-Russian tinge to it. And I said, do you mean anti-Russian or anti-Putin? He says, it's not anti-Putin, it's anti-Russian. He says, because there's anger in this country, in Ukraine, that the Russian population has let Putin do this to us. That was 2 years ago. And I can only imagine that that anger and that unhappiness at Russia has only grown. And that's not going to be a healthy thing. I mean, you cannot change the fact that Ukraine and Russia are neighbors. But Putin has done huge damage to Russia's image in Ukraine. And he's taken a country where, when I served there at the end of the 1990s, you know, most Ukrainians, you know, wanted to get along with Russia. You know, they saw value. They had contacts with Russians. And I think that's changed in the last 15 years in a very negative way for Russia as a result of the Kremlin policies. That's unfortunate.
Well, Stephen Pieper, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pieper, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking further into the Senate hearings and the growing rift between the president-elect and the intelligence community. But they beg you, wait my name. I got one hell of a job, performed for the U.S. of A. Got the responsibility of our nation's top security. But every night and day.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy. I'm at home in the streets of Rome.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Simon Rosenberg, the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer for ABC News. And before that, he worked on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns and was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. He's also a columnist for U.S. News and World Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Simon Rosenberg.
Good to be here, Ian.
And this denial and doubling down on denial on the part of President-elect Donald Trump about Russian involvement in meddling with the recent election and the notion that Vladimir Putin may well have helped Donald Trump get elected and hurt Hillary Clinton. Obviously, that's an uncomfortable truth for Donald Trump. I can imagine why he resists that notion. But he appears now to reversing himself from yesterday when he tweeted out support for Julian Assange. Now he's saying he supports the intelligence community ahead of Friday's meeting with the top the heads of the various U.S. intelligence agencies. Yep. So today there was a hearing on in the Senate, and Clapper, the DNI, addressed the senators along with the head of the National Security Agency, Admiral Rogers. So what did you make from today's hearing? It seemed to lay the groundwork of, one, tomorrow they're going to be talking with Trump, and on Monday they're going to be releasing a full report to the public. Obviously, it'll be redacted, a report which I believe the president got today.
Yeah, I mean, I have two basic sort of observations about all this. One is, it is, you know, I've been in national politics and media for 30 years, and I'm a student of history, and I don't know that America has witnessed anything like what it's witnessed in the last few months in Trump's repeated denial of what is obvious fact, right? I mean, it's sort of the equivalent of him saying the sky is red when we all know it is blue. I mean, it is undeniable what happened. I mean, there have been stories, you know, that have detailed how the FBI saw the Russians going into the DNC in September of 2015. I mean, these are well-established facts. I've advised the DNC and worked with the DNC, so I have some window into what actually happened. And it's impossible to question the reality of what happened. It's just, it should disturb all of us that a prominent public figure in the country has maintained, despite overwhelming evidence to the opposite case, that he's continued to maintain this and deny what really happened. Now, why that is, we can debate. We don't really know, and this story is just playing out. It's going to go on. But the second piece that really matters here is that it's obscuring and it's preventing his incoming administration from dealing squarely with one of the greatest threats to the West and to the United States that we've faced in a very long time, right? And that's what I call the Russian insurgency against the West, which is playing out throughout Europe right now. It's now come to the United States. And, you know, what I hope is that the Trump administration becomes a warrior against this insurgency. I mean, what I'm nervous about, based on things that he has said and positions that he's taken, that in fact he's going to be an enabler of it. And I think that this is a huge, you know, challenge, frankly, for the United States and for, you know, the national security of the people of this country.
Well, there's a couple of possible explanations for why Donald Trump, in effect, protects Putin and denies the reality of what's happened, what appears to have happened. One would be that Putin's blackmailing him. There's some stories about that, which we don't need to go into. We can if you like, but some of it's not entirely sourced, but a lot of smoke, maybe some fire there. We know that he's been blackballed by U.S. banks. He's taken them down for a lot of his bankruptcies, so he had to look for capital elsewhere, and there are suggestions that maybe the oligarchs and he have a financial arrangement that's hidden in his tax returns that he never released. So that's on the negative side. On the positive side, if that's the right way to put it, there's a possibility that Rex Tillerson, being chosen for Secretary of State, being a close friend of Putin, somebody that has a big oil deal in Siberia on hold because of sanctions, could mean a major geopolitical play where the U.S. helps Russia develop its Siberian oil and gas. It gets piped into the Asian markets. It makes China dependent upon Russian energy in the way that Western Europe is dependent upon Gazprom, and therefore has some leverage. And it would be a reverse of the Nixon 72 play, where Nixon opened up to China, where U.S. and China relied against Russia. In this case, it would be U.S. and Russia relying against China. If that is indeed a possibility, then one could understand why Trump is trying to protect that relationship. So,
yeah, I mean, let me just respond to that, because I think that, you know, I've written about this extensively, including, you know, way before the election. I started writing about this and talking about this during the summer, when we started to learn about what happened to the DNC. But my own view on this is that, you know, that Putin is essentially, I mean, if you want to try to describe what he's doing, right, is that it's revenge to weaken the people that took down his country, and that the world that has grown since 1989 in the fall of the old Soviet Union is that America has built, essentially created a global system that has moved most of the world underneath our both hard and soft orbit, right? The global trading system that we have, the United Nations, which we constructed, and that this has benefited us dramatically, economically, right? We've seen tremendous progress towards free market capitalism around the world and a march, I hope, continued march towards more democratic systems around the world. And that the world has remained remarkably peaceful and prosperous for a very long time under our, you know, smart vision and sound stewardship. And what Russia is now trying to do is to try to essentially weaken or disable that world that we built, because it is leaving them in the dust and further in the dustbin of history. They can't compete with the United States. They can't compete with China, right? And part of what you're seeing is this alliance, to what you said, right, between the oil-producing countries and then those that make things in the world, right, that rely more on traditional capitalism, which needs a global free market, which needs the internet, which views the rise of petro-dictators and petro-politics to be a threat to their own prosperity. And so what happened at the end of last year, right, was that the world came together, led by the United States and China, and said that we're going to end this reign of petro-politics and this dominance of oil, both for many different reasons, right? Safety, the health of the planet and the health of all of us, and also because it's given a small number of countries a ridiculous leverage point over everybody else. It's made commerce very expensive. And that we're going to attack this. And you saw the Saudis react, right? The Saudis have now started making massive investments in things that don't have to do with oil and gas, right? They recognize that the days of oil are coming to an end. And what Russia's doing, in my mind, and what I'm worried about that our president is playing into this, is unwittingly participating in an effort to weaken free market capitalism by weakening the, you know, his arguments he's making about trade right now and sort of attacking companies that are doing legitimate investments in other countries, right? That's, you know, the tariff system I'll come to a quick end here, but the tariffs he's proposing would begin to unravel the global trade system, right? Putin doesn't make a lot of money off the global trade system. He sells oil, right? That's where all their wealth comes from. That doesn't matter to him, right? Second, the Paris Accords, they're going to get unraveled very quickly. Third is, you know, TPP, pulling back on TPP, which would have been a dramatic modernization and advance in the global trading system needed, right, to update it for the digital age, right? We can go through all these things that he's doing and the steps that Trump is taking that feel ideologically aligned with a politics that sees the free market, sees the global trading system, sees global capitalism outside the reach of oil and gas, right, to be a threat to them. And that's why the embrace of Rex Tillerson, the thing that you're describing, is so worrisome to me. And the fact that so many oil and gas people are littered now throughout the entire administration, because the last thing the United States should be doing is supporting, you know, a sort of tacitly, you know, either implicitly, explicitly, a move towards global petro politics. What oil has done is that virtually all of the instability in the world today can be traced back to money, to oil money, and countries that have been corrupted by oil. And we, for the good of the people of the world, and free market capitalism and political liberty and all the things that America has always stood for, and the fight against totalitarianism and aggressive, you know, overly aggressive governments, is to end this reign of petropolitics around the world. And so I'm alarmed, frankly, in what I'm seeing in the early stages of the Trump transition. And I think that Rex Tillerson would be a catastrophic mistake for the United States on virtually every level. I mean, it's really, to me, one of the worst political decisions that I've ever seen, and I hope that Democrats have the fortitude to take him down, working with McCain. I mean, we're very close to getting Tillerson out. I mean, McCain and Graham have already said that they're not going to support him. If Democrats hold fast, we only need one more Republican, and Tillerson won't make it as Secretary of State. So, anyway, there's a lot here, and I think there's a lot of reasons that Americans should be worried about the ideological direction that Trump is beginning to lead the country.
But when you say that Putin is animated by the collapse of the Soviet Union, which he blames on Western powers, of course, that is a convenient delusion, because the Soviet Union collapsed under its own weight. It was a
right. It
was a political, military, secret police system pretending to be an economy. And this is one of the things that's troubling. My understanding is that this operation to hack the U.S. elections was very controversial, even within the FSB and the SVR, and that Ivanov, his chief of staff, objected to it, thought it was reckless, as did Medvedev, his prime minister. And he's eased them out. He's got a new, a younger chief of staff and a bunch of sycophants around him, younger Russians who don't remember the Soviet Union and therefore don't know why it collapsed and are susceptible to Putin's new mythology that Russia's greatness was stolen from it by the West and it has to reassert itself. So I'm not sure what you can do dealing with a gangster state, dealing with this unusual hybrid of national security and organized crime, and the ability of them to wage this new form of hybrid warfare.
But we have to at least begin to try. I mean, I think it's clear that what's happened in recent years is, starting with Snowden, that Putin, took incremental steps towards this current trajectory they're on, right? I mean, one of the things that you have to connect the dots on is, why is Putin really in Syria? I mean, what's the, yes, there's a warm water port there. Yes, he wants to show himself to be a big man, but he's aligning himself in the Middle East with the Shia powers, who are the minority powers in the region. I mean, it doesn't really make smart geopolitical sense over the long haul for the Russian government to be aligning themselves so closely with a mass murderer and Iran, when virtually all the rest of the wealth in the region and the power comes from Sunni-led governments, right? So what's the play? The play, in my mind, in part, is to keep the civil war going, to keep the refugee crisis going, in order to continue to destabilize Europe. I think at the end of the day, what Putin's main objective is, at a strategy level, right, is to weaken the West, and to weaken the values of the West, to undermine the concept of democracies being legitimate forms of government, to weaken the global trading system, to weaken NATO, to weaken our intelligence agencies, to weaken the idea of America, right, which has been the bane of Russian existence over, generations now. And I think that he's having enormous success. You're seeing the rise of all these far-right powers throughout all of Europe. The center-left is in utter total collapse now. The modern center-left is in utter total collapse in Europe. And you're seeing, I think part of what we have to deal with is that Putin, I call it an insurgency, whatever the language is we're going to use to describe this, we're either going to confront it head on, and as we've confronted other threats throughout all of our history, right, coming up with strategies, trying new things, right, talking about it in public as we did today in an unprecedented way. I mean, one of the things I'm concerned about, I blame President Obama, frankly, for not creating a greater public dialogue around what was happening over the last several years. This is not a new thing that's happening here. I mean, I had meetings in the White House about these things 2 years ago that were going on. I mean, this is not for anyone who is paying attention. The beginning of the weakening of the of Europe was evident, self-evident years ago, right? And so, I think that my view on this is that, this is not a Cold War. It's ridiculous to put Russia in its current state, with an economy the size of Italy, right, to be, at an equal footing to the United States and the sort of binary kind of thing that we had during the Cold War. This is an insurgency of a minor power with lots of nuclear weapons who had remarkable success because we haven't created a public understanding and strategy to work together to preserve the West, modernize it for a new day, right, but to fight for our values and the things that we believe. And this has been I think the European powers in our own country have not stepped up to confront this head on. I think, and the problem is now, is that it's not clear that the next president actually wants to confront it. It seems like he actually is ally of this politics, right? Which is one of the reasons that you're seeing Europeans be so concerned, because they don't want Russians further into their business throughout the the kind of politics that the Russians are supporting. Look, just a couple weeks ago, and you're a well-read guy, you understand this. I mean, Russian nationals were arrested in Montenegro for trying to overthrow the democratically elected government of Montenegro, right? This just happened a few weeks ago. I mean, we're talking about far more than cyber intrusion now. We're talking about, you know, just like what happened in Crimea, we're seeing the Russians begin to get deeply involved now in the internal politics of every country in Europe. I had lunch recently with a prominent French minister who told me at lunch that right now in the French parliament, Putin has more votes than the United States does, right? And so we were asleep at the switch on this and what's happened. And it is one Clapper, I think, described today, used the terms existential threat to describe what the Russians are doing. I don't know if I would go that far, and I have to go back and read the full transcript of what he said, but we are facing a remarkable threat to the idea of the United States, the order that we built after World War II, and we have to confront it head on. I know that's something I'm going to be working on. I don't know that the next government coming in for our country understands us the way that we do, which is why I think today's hearing, I want to applaud John McCain for having, you know, put a lot of important stuff on the table for people to chew over. And I think with the release of the report, the briefing of Trump tomorrow, right, we're going to know more. Now, the question is why, right? And the question is this because of that he's been compromised by Putin, or because he's actually an ideological fellow traveler, right? I mean, if you read Steve Bannon's writings in the past and you look at interviews, I mean, Steve Bannon appears to be an ideological supporter of illiberal politics here and around the world, right? And illiberalism, whatever we want to call it, and Putinism. And I think that I think we will know in the future when we look back on this, there were two things drawing this, is that there is the beginning to become formerly inchoate, but now slightly coherent, sort of illiberal understanding in the West, right, of what an illiberal politics would be, which is something that we didn't really have in Western politics for a very long time. And also, there's clearly some deep relationship between Donald Trump and the current Russian government that we will someday learn more about. There's no question his defense. I mean, look, he could have, for a guy that yesterday was praised for being so savvy, or 2 days ago being so savvy for, sort of pushing the House Republicans away from this ridiculous place they were going with this ethics stuff, right? I mean, he got lots of praise for stepping in early and shutting it down and helping prevent the Republicans from doing grave damage to themselves. That same media-savvy guy is willing to allow the world to believe that he's in cahoots with, one of the worst people in one of the worst countries on the face of the earth, right? I mean, what is to his advantage when he's so concerned about his own image? He seems utterly unconcerned with the affiliation with Putin, right?
Right.
I mean, and so I don't know where this is all going, but certainly I think average everyday Americans and proud patriots should be very worried about, the signals that are being sent. And certainly the whole retraction, I mean, my own view about the retraction on the intelligence stuff today is that there are clearly competing camps in control of his Twitter feed, right? I mean, there are sort of more politically savvy manifestations of Trump that are probably being controlled by Reince Priebus and Kellyanne Conway. And then I'm sure that Bannon has got his own sort of, carved out territory, because the tweets about Russia, about domestic intelligence, even the tweets, I would argue, about American businesses, or foreign businesses like Toyota today, this stuff is borderline crazy talk, right? This is not within the bounds of acceptable sort of politics or discourse in the United States. And then there's this other manifestation of the tweets, right? So I think one of the things we're going to learn, is that there's clearly a war going on already inside of Trump world between the radicals, right, and the more establishment forces in the administration, the incoming administration. You could just see it based on what happened in the last 24, 36 hours, right? I mean, and my concern is that a majority of Trump's tweets right now, and he's not even in office yet, I would put in the radical and, you know, almost crazy camp. And I think that's why, you know, I'm worried. I'm just as worried about him attacking Toyota today than I am about, you know, I mean, Toyota is making a legitimate, you know, the world's biggest car company, a global company, high quality, makes remarkable cars, right? Is highly regarded in the United States, massive employer of Americans, right? Setting up a factory in Mexico, right, where Mexico has lots of free trade agreements, and somehow Trump attacks a normal business transaction of a global company for, by the way, with our second largest trading partner and very close geopolitical ally, Mexico, right? I mean, this is unstable, crazy stuff. This is not a sustainable dialogue. This is like a four-year-old, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, bouncing
well,
stuff
but
around.
That, but
so
that's what it's all about.
It's going to be a very, very mm-hmm. bumpy and difficult period for the United States. And,
right. Well,
and I think that, you know, those of us, whatever party you're in, right? And I'm very proud that there have been many Republicans who've stood up to him. There are many. Paul Ryan, Ted Cruz, in the last few days, you know, trashed Trump for the Julian Assange stuff. I mean, that crossed a line inside the Republican Party, right? Mm-hmm. And so this isn't a Democrat-Republican thing. This is a, you know, this is a going to realign along other lines that I'm not yet sure about if Trump continues to go down the road that he's going.
Well, we have to wrap up, but a lot of points there that I want just wanted to touch on a few. You write about France. Fillon, the new leader, likely to be elected, is very pro-Putin. But there is an explanation, I think, tying in with the oil play with Tillerson and Putin developing Siberian oil, capturing the Asian markets, which will affect the Gulf, the alliance with Russia and alliance with the Shia via Iran makes sense when you consider that Iran now has the Shia crescent. It can essentially, through proxies, controls Iraq, Syria and Lebanon, and will prevent the Gulf states from developing the pipelines that they want to put through to the Mediterranean to make their gas competitive with Gazprom. So again, if you consider that Vladimir Putin's thesis at St. Petersburg's College of Minerals, when he studied both economics and law, his thesis was on how to use oil and gas pipelines for geopolitical power. So to my mind, you know, this is the last gasp of the old economy, which which is going to kill the planet through global warming.
Right.
But
it's killing people. I mean, let's just be very clear, Ian, and I think this is the thing I covered in my piece, and we'll wrap up, is that it's also killing people through instability and through terrorism, and so much of the instability in the world today can be traced back to oil money and reckless politics of oil dictators. And so you're right. I mean, I understand the Iran. I didn't want to go through all that. I didn't think we had time today, but I appreciate your understanding of this. But, you know, these are enormous challenges. And thank you for your intelligent, sorry I went on so long, but I'm still myself grappling with how to talk about this in plain English, right? I mean, this is such an emergent and kind of shocking set of events that we're all, I think, trying to create a better understanding. So thank you for your good work.
Well, thank you for joining us here today, Simon Rosenberg.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Simon Rosenberg, who's the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News and worked on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. He's also a columnist for U.S. News and World Report. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the dilemma facing Republicans who want to immediately repeal Obamacare but do not have anything to replace it with.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Wendell Potter, the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. After a long career in the for-profit health industry as the chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., he is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. His latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Thank you, Ian.
And it looks as though the Republicans, well, first of all, they're clearly determined to repeal Obamacare, but it doesn't seem like they really have anything to replace it with. And they got a pep talk from Mike Pence, Vice President-elect, yesterday. And it looks as though they're pulling off some legislative maneuvers here to get around a Democratic filibuster. They're going to pass a budget resolution that would shield repeal legislation from a Democratic filibuster and thus enabling the GOP to gut the Affordable Care Act in the form of a reconciliation bill. So it looks like they'll get away with it, but will they get away with not having anything to replace it with?
No, they won't. There's just a lack of understanding of how the health insurance market works on the part of so many lawmakers. And I observed this when I was spending quite a bit of time in Washington during the healthcare reform debate in 2009 and 2010. Another problem is that the Republicans from the very beginning saw this as an opportunity to gain some political advantage. And the Republicans called it a government takeover of healthcare from day one. And they said that so often they began to believe it, and they really were successful in using it to political advantage. But now they're in this situation in which they are expected to deliver, and they're in a predicament. They're really in between a rock and a hard place, because what they are proposing to do, which presumably is to repeal it whatever way they can, but then postpone replacing it, just will not work. It will create such havoc, such chaos in the marketplace that people will point the finger of blame, I'm certain, at the Republicans for really taking health care away from many, many millions of people.
And the other thing that seems to be happening in this health care arena, if you will, is President-elect Donald Trump's pick for the health secretary, Tom Price, the Georgia congressman, an orthopedic surgeon. The Wall Street Journal recently reported that Price bought and sold more than $300,000 in stock in about 40 healthcare, pharmaceutical, and biomedical companies over the past 4 years, at the same time advocating legislation that could influence those companies' shares. That's apparently being forwarded to the ethics office, the very office that the Republicans tried to kill on their first day. Do you think that's going to have any legs?
I don't know. It very possibly could. I think it definitely deserves and warrants investigation. With the Republicans in control of both houses of Congress and the White House, I certainly wouldn't hold my breath to think that that he might not be confirmed. It's a possibility. But I just don't have a lot of confidence that there's a lot of attention being paid to ethics in Washington right now.
So back to the big issue then on the Affordable Care Act. You think that, in effect, the Republicans are prisoners of their own political rhetoric. It was, first of all, I don't think the Affordable Care Act was particularly popular. They demonized it from day one. A lot of people, right, particularly the middle-class people, their premiums went up. Obviously, for the uninsured, the 20 million people that are brought into the system, they liked it and they benefited from it. So where do you think it stands in terms of support versus those that would want to see it gotten rid of? I know that Trump himself has even indicated that there are certain aspects of it that are popular, like keeping your kids on their parents' insurance till they're 26 and not discriminating against pre-existing conditions. So where does it stand in terms of public opinion and popularity, do you think?
Well, all the polls have shown consistently that there's a minority of people who don't like it and would like to see it repealed. And I say a minority. Now, when you
delve into the numbers, you see that a lot of people want to keep it. A lot of people are dissatisfied with it because they felt it didn't go far enough. And when you add those two together, the people who like it or think it's okay and those who don't think it goes far enough, that's a majority of people. And the people who are against it and want to see it repealed are in the minority. So that's one thing. Now, the Republicans, the Republican politicians have created the impression, and maybe they believe it as well, that most Americans don't like it and would like to get rid of it. That's just simply not the case. So they've got a real problem on their hands. They've been incredibly successful as messengers, as communicators, to demonize it, and I'll give them that. They really did get their base worked up, and the base is expecting them to deliver. Now that they are in a position to be able to do exactly that, they're in a dilemma. They're realizing, I'm sure the lobbyists for the insurance industry and for the hospitals and others are frantically trying to convince or help these lawmakers understand the consequences of what they're about to apparently do. It can be devastating to the hospitals around the country, and the insurance companies just simply won't play along. And here's why. Most Americans are now enrolled in health plans that are owned and operated by companies like I used to work for, like the big for-profit insurance companies. And the CEOs and executives of those companies, they answer to shareholders. And the shareholders expect them to make decisions that are in their best interest first and foremost. And they always do that. They're not going to stick around and wait for 4 years or 2 years or even 1 year for the Republicans to come around with some kind of a replacement plan. There's no assurance of when they might do that. So you will start seeing insurance companies bailing out of the exchanges, and people will have very few options, and many of them will be just, quite frankly, back in the ranks of the uninsured. The Republicans don't like the fact that the government is providing subsidies to help people buy coverage, but people can't buy coverage. They couldn't before the Affordable Care Act was passed. 50 million people were uninsured then, and the primary reason was because health insurance had become so unaffordable. One of the things that the Republicans have done is create this impression that it's because of the Affordable Care Act that healthcare premiums are going up. That's not true, for the most part. People have forgotten that health insurance premiums were going up very rapidly before it was passed. But there is this impression that's been created by opponents of the law that Obamacare is the problem and should be blamed for rate increases and everything else is wrong with the healthcare system, and undeservedly so.
So just in the last few minutes, Wendell, I mean, we are the only country that, in terms of the advanced democracies, that don't have single-payer health care.
Right.
And the Canadians right next door, of course, have it. And the reason it works, and it's infinitely less expensive, this is what, up around 18% of our GDP and growing. It's maybe even more than 18% now, and it's around 6% of the GDP in the countries that have single-payer, simply because there is no justification for having the insurance companies in the healthcare business in the first place, because all they do is add their overhead to a simple relationship that should exist between the caregiver and the patient. So, I mean, it's even if you give money to the mafia, you know, maybe you get a little protection, but you get nothing from these guys except they charge you for their very existence, and they don't bring anything to the table except aggravation. So it's a broken system to begin with, and clearly the Clintons had a hard time with the insurance company lobby, and then Obama decided to go along with them and bring them into the tent. Yeah. And now you think they're going to abandon him and basically go back to a free-for-all, laissez-faire market that they had before the ACA?
They want to do whatever is in their short-term business interest, and that they will not stick with the Republicans or the Democrats for very long. They, I know, are very troubled with what they're seeing as potential disaster that the Republicans could create. They certainly don't have any allegiance to the Democrats either. It's all for financial gain, as you were saying. Who knows exactly how it's going to play out, but you can rest assured that the money that is being spent to influence lawmakers will far outweigh, by the special interests, will far outweigh the money that's being spent by what few organizations are that represent consumers. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. You are exactly right. I think at some point, Americans and American businesses in particular are going to wake up to exactly what you were saying, that these companies don't have what they have referred to for many years as their value proposition. What is the value that they bring to our healthcare system? And I think it's going to become increasingly clear that it doesn't exist. They cannot control healthcare costs. They contribute to rising healthcare costs. And I think we'll probably have the chance of seeing trying to go back to the era before the Affordable Care Act was passed. You can't do that. You'll see, like I said before, such chaos created, such and pain and suffering and death that will result from the chaos that will be created.
So, but just in closing, when you say their lobbyists obviously are really powerful and they've been very effective in lobbying, they killed off the Clinton half-hearted effort and they've helped shape the Obama effort, what would they be lobbying for? Do they really know what they want at this point?
Well, they want to try to stabilize the market as best they can. Again, they don't like to have risk. What they would like to do if they were in the driver's seat would be to keep the things that the Republicans say they don't like. They cannot abide by keeping the pre-existing condition prohibition and also get rid of the individual mandate. It just doesn't work. And the Republicans are probably finding that out. You might try to get rid of some things that you don't like and are ideologically opposed to, but if you do that, you know, the whole thing falls apart. It's a big mess that the Republicans now find themselves in. And what are they going to lobbying for? If they were able to try to keep the market together, they would like to be able to go back to being able to charge women more than men, charge older people more, far more than they can today. They'd like to be able to get rid of the provision of the Affordable Care Act that requires them to spend 80% of our premium dollars at least on health care. They would like to be able to use health status to determine how much to charge people. They'd like to go back to that. They'd love to sell junk insurance again, like I said. So those are the things they'd like to have, and they may get some of that, but that will certainly be to their short-term advantage and to the certainly disadvantage of the rest of us.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Wendell Potter.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who has a long career in the for-profit health industry as the chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation, as head of corporate communications at Humana. He is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity, and his latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.